Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
On my mind, walking on icy beach sand, starlit and bright, crunching under my new shoes, bought by my wife. I must confess I've had doubts about my life, keep telling myself that there's honor and compromise, telling it to the moon like it was an agent of God. Do I look like half a person? 'Cause sometimes that's just how I feel. When I get sick, I feel that love so strong. Frailty and independence will one day come along. Dying in a strange place, wishing we could simply go home. I wish that I could burn this ring to my skin and tell a million people you changed the man that I've been. Safety and lightning and love are found in your arms. I hear possession is poison. Well, strictly, I don't think that's true. But I'm going through the motions today. My eyes shut tight to the one all around me. Going through the motions today. My eyes shut tight to the one all around me. Admit that I pray, open and hopeless and earnest in varying degrees. You can laugh, you can say what you like. You keep Richard Dawkins, it'll take Jesus Christ to take away my burden of conscience and clear out my mind. So does that sound like a problem? Today, my eyes shut tight to the one who all around me.
Back in March this year, we were very privileged and delighted to be able to welcome to the Midweek Drive an awesome Scottish songster who, as I said at the time, is producing anthemic material. And indeed, as a couple of my co-hosts are also saying, it was the soundtrack to the summer and summer festivals, etc. Well, the great news is he's back now and he's got an even more awesome single that we're going to chat about. Who am I referring to? This legend from March 2021 on the Midweek Drive? Well, it's only Willie Campbell. How are you, Willie?
I'm very well, thank you very much for having me back on. It's nice to see you again.
Well, absolutely. It's just the two of us this time around. I think it's something to do with Thanksgiving. It's taken away some of our American things. I don't know, it's some kind of event. I think it's a holiday that they have over there. So that or Black Friday. I mean, these Americans, what could you say? They do their own thing, obviously.
They make it up as they go along.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, well, you've seen both their presidents, but still, never mind. Life continues. Now, we launched today with a reprise of a classic Willie number that we actually put together because we've just been listening, in fact, to the wonderful world of Going Through the Motions, which obviously was an early track number. But you've actually done something even more wonderful and you started opening up a whole new field. So, well, first of all, tell us what's been happening since March this year, because it's a few months back.
Yeah, I've been busy. I've finished, well, I started an album. I kind of got a bit sidetracked and I started co-writing another album with a guy called Norman Patterson. And along with that, I've started doing some work with schools about historical, trying to tell stories with older primary age kids about folklore and their surroundings and develop an appreciation for their history and stuff. So it's been a really, really interesting year. And it's sort of, weirdly enough, all the COVID stuff has pushed me out of my comfy spot of just gigging and forced me into moving into other projects. So it's not all been bad, actually, but I'm really happy with this new set of co-written songs with Norman Patterson. He's a 64-year-old guy who'd never written a song before. I started doing Zoom songwriting sessions with him as a teacher, and he just has this incredible knack for lyrics. So that's kind of grown arms and legs and turned into an album project.
Well, that is quite amazing. Presumably that's why we now refer to you as Willie Campbell and the Stations. Is that right?
Yeah, I just thought just to create a bit of definition between my own solo stuff and this project that I'm co-writing with Norman, I thought it was just a bit of a distinction between the two things, because my own solo album in its own right isn't out yet, so it's going to be the first half of next year that comes out too.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, whenever I hear your name, Willie, and we talk about you quite a lot, actually, I always tend to think of the classic Sunday Post character, Ur Willie. Ever been tempted to actually just release a track as Ur Willie, you know, in terms of that? It's a thought, you know, just to the live. Anyway, moving on, and let's sort of move to a different zone. I just can't make 64, you said, that Norman actually is, and he's never written a song before. Obviously, he engaged with you himself for this.
No, he'd never written a song. I was about to start songwriting classes, which I was invited to do because I'm imposter syndrome, and somebody had to do this when I'm a bit unsure of it myself a lot of the time. But Norman was a bit disappointed those classes never went ahead, so we started doing stuff one to one, and just a really creative person and a very open, and the few pointers I gave him, he just took them and absolutely ran with them and has done amazing things. So some really beautiful songs he's written.
I very much forget the whole notion of the old Lennon and McCartney when I'm 64. Clearly he's working through that whole process effortlessly. Obviously inspired by your good self, Willie. I mean, I think it's fair to say that's where the sort of magic is happening. And we're going to listen to this in a few moments. But let's talk a little bit more about, obviously, the Isle of Lewis, which is obviously where you're based. We're hearing now, obviously, that South Africa is now back on the red list. We've got the new version of COVID new, as opposed to COVID Delta, another variant coming through from that point of view. In terms of when we last spoke, obviously, again, earlier in the year, we were talking about obviously getting back into gigging in various other areas. Do you think it's a case of people are adapting to this pandemic and epidemic, etc., in the way that humans always adapt to things, and we're just having to cope, basically?
think that's the way things are going. I reckon it was handled reasonably well in a sense. Everybody was extremely cautious because, at the first few months, it could have been, you know, people, I had visions of a complete apocalypse going on in my head. It's like, it sort of feels to me like people are just doing what you said. It's just, it's going to get to the point where we're just going to have to live with it. And young people from the gigs that I've played so far are very much living with it. They're just jumping up and down and sweating all over each other. And just, I don't know. I don't know where it's going to stop, but it feels to me like, yeah, we are just going to have to learn how to adapt and live with it now.
Now, if memory serves, you've got two children yourself. How have they been sort of coping with the whole thing? And is it a case of whenever there's a new song produced by your good self, there's a great deal of excitement in the Campbell household?
Yeah, they still are at an age where they think I'm relatively cool. My wee girl's 11 now, so any day now she's going to think I'm really embarrassing. So I'll make the best of that while she still thinks that way. I also got into another project this year called the Dalmar Chorus with a guy called Kapil Sishasai, and we wrote songs about the well-being economy and played a gig at COP26. So that was really interesting. And my son really loves that stuff because it's got more of a kind of dance beat in a way. So yeah, they still sing with me when I do a live stream as well. They're always a bit of a highlight when people tune into it.
Yeah. And of course, you mentioned COP26. I mean, clearly, all sorts of things happening there. What do you feel? Do you think it was a success, or do you take Greta Thunberg's view that it was a lot of hot air and a PR opportunity for the Northern Hemisphere?
I mean, I think I'm sort of somewhere in between. The fact that there's still a need for it at all suggests there's an awful lot of work to do, and I mean, there's so much greed involved. It's just inevitably going to take time. But is it time that we have? That's the problem. I think until there's like catastrophes and severe crisis, I think in the West we're just going to be dragging our feet until it is a little bit too late, and then there'll be all of this compensating. I mean, it's better than them not doing anything at all. Put it that way.
Yeah, I must admit, I do think with the technology that we've demonstrated on Midweek Drive, and indeed you demonstrated with the Zoom packages yourself, I'm not sure how essential it was for everybody to actually use jets to actually fly into the whole piece. But maybe that should be being old-fashioned, what the hey. Willie, let's talk about something we're going to listen now. I'm going to press the button in terms of the things. It's Willie Campbell on the stations, and it's Invisible Things. Share with us the sort of backstory between this and indeed project put together with yourself and indeed fellow Lewis man. I mean, obviously, yeah, I thought you were the sole inhabitant of the Isle of Lewis, actually, yourself and the family. But no, Norman Paterson's there as well. So share with us what the sort of story is behind, obviously, what we're about to hear now, which is Invisible Things.
Well, this was our first collaboration, and Norman sent me these words, which I did refine a little bit, because when you first start songwriting, you sometimes add extra words and extra syllables that maybe don't need to be there, and sometimes people don't realize they're over repeating. So I just cut it down a little bit, just trimmed some of the fat off, and I wrote a melody around Norman's words, and we just worked remotely. That's how we've been doing this album. It's just the technology is incredible these days, and I'm really happy with this single. I mixed it myself and produced it in the house, and it's satisfying to feel that side of my ability is getting a bit better now, I think, after just lots of swearing and YouTubing and searching about how to work EQs. And yeah, I'm really happy with this song. So thank you very much for playing it.
There's an invisible line between blood and hate. Live through the curves, most days it's straight. Sometimes you cross, often parts are new, but the compromise crumbles, we don't pass through. We live to the laws of invisible things. The order 'cause I think it's abandoned.
Tremendous, terrific Invisible Things there by, of course, Willie Campbell and the Stations. And I suppose it's just one station this particular thing, it's Norman Patterson. Willie, one of the key things that's come across from listening to that, and it is awesome, we know that, is the art of the songwriter and that whole aspect. I mean, we're doing a feature, actually, about a New York singer-songwriter who I'm not sure whether you ever encountered the delights of Harry Chapin. Is that somebody who has ever crossed your path, the thoughts of Harry Chapin, Man of Cats in the Cradle, WOLD, Sequel, and so on?
Oh, Cats in the Cradle, yeah, I know that song. Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the stuff, though, to be honest.
Well,
a gem I need to discover?
He sadly passed away 40 years ago, which is one of the reasons we're actually having a 40th anniversary reprise for the late, great Harry Chapin. He was very much responsible for actually becoming an activist. And in many ways, Harry Chapin paved the way for what Sir Bob Geldof later did with Live Aid. He kind of opened up a whole range of things, very committed to world hunger. But the thing about Harry Chapin is he started off as a filmmaker. And he very much was, he wasn't a successful filmmaker by his own admission, but he moved to songs. And what he always liked to do is to tell a story. And again, I'll pop in just at the end of this piece, a Harry Chapin number, Short Stories, which is one example of that. My question really for you, Willie, is do you actually have a narrative in mind with respect to the story? Now, obviously, you've said in this case, Norman wrote the lyrics. But when you're obviously writing things from that point of view, do you sometimes feel as though there is a story and a narrative that you're looking to develop and evolve, a bit like balladeers have always done through the ages?
Well, I think it's just, it sounds a bit, maybe a little obvious to say, but there aren't particularly any rules with songwriting in a sense, because you can be writing from a deeply personal point of view, or you can be writing some kind of a story. My dad told me years ago that my great-grandfather was sailed on clipper ships. So I wrote this, I just imagined this scenario and did some research about clipper ships, some of the last ones. It was one called City of Adelaide. So I kind of went into quite a lot of detail, and I found that really fun, like researching a song. But I don't think there's any particularly hard and fast rules, as long as there's something memorable in there. Mm. That's my, you know, I'm from a, my dad pumped 60s music into my head from as long as I can remember, just 60s tapes in the car and stuff. And don't bore us, get to the chorus, you know what I mean? That's still, even no matter how clever I'm trying to be in my writing, there has to be something memorable in there so that, you know, it stays with you. That's the only rule I really have, I guess. something strong for the chorus.
I mean, I think you can certainly sort of, if we look back, and clearly they're back in vogue, if they were ever out of vogue, etc. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison and Ringo Starr with their work, certainly on Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, a lot of other areas. I'm not sure whether you'd be looking at the recent Peter Jackson documentary about the Beatles and Get Back. I mean, I'm thinking if Jackson has got any idea whatsoever, he should be getting his cameras up to the Isle of Lewis and actually doing a whole feature on your good self. But in terms of that process of working, I mean, you shared with us how you kind of got together with Norman and how that was using a new technology thing. Do you think that that's one sort of way of actually addressing things, or is it just a case of when the muse strikes, that's what you go with?
I no, not necessarily. About 10 years ago, I got a publishing deal with a company that were based in Nashville, and I went out there to write songs in a writing room environment. So basically, you clocked in at 9 o'clock, you left at 5:30, and sometimes you might have 3 writing sessions in a day. And basically, that developed my discipline in a way. You can't wait for inspiration. It's volume a lot of the time. So if you write 6 songs, one of them might be a gem, and the 4 or 5 other ones you might pick from later on down the line. And so, I don't particularly wait for inspiration. I always just pick up my guitar and see what comes out. And I think anyone can do it. Anyone can write a song. It's just the refining that you have to learn about.
Yeah, you may say that, Willie, but I think it involves a special talent from that point of view. Now, you mentioned obviously Nashville there, and one thing we didn't talk about in March, which I certainly had on my list of we must talk about that next time around, an estate car and a PA. The BBC documentary, which documented your return to Lewis and indeed experience. Who came up with the title, An Estate Car and a PA?
It was the director, Don Coutts, that made up that title, because that was kind of it for me. I had a black Audi and my PA system in the back of it, and I would just drive up and down Scotland playing in hotels and bars and stuff. So he thought it was quite an appropriate title. I went to Nashville for that documentary as well, and they kind of painted a picture of it being, I don't know, not something that was already part of my life in a way, so to make the narrative of the documentary work a bit better. But I was in 2 minds about doing it, actually. I checked with my family and stuff, because a lot of it was quite personal, really. It kind of went right into how things had fallen apart for me as a young man with Astrid and things like that.
Or maybe falling together. It's just a case you don't recognise it at the time. You know, Astrid did get back together again in 2019 in any case.
Absolutely. And I moved to Lewis and I met my wife, and everything happens just as it's meant to a lot of the time, even though you can't see the reason when you're in the chaos of it. But yeah, it all worked out as it was meant to. Yeah. But I enjoyed the process of that documentary. It was very odd, but I'm glad I did it, really.
Well, that's what I was saying. I mean, I think, you know, if Peter Jackson's got anything about him, he'll be on the phone now. I mean, the studio actually acknowledges that. You know, we're raising that profile. The message is getting out there. As we said, we've heard the single once. I'm sure we'll play it again. It is available. It's released, obviously, it depends when you're listening to this. Yeah, it is released today, 26th of November. If you're listening to it after the 26th of November, go and get it now. It's called Invisible Things by Willie Campbell and the Stations. So that's in place for that point of view. I mean, back in the day, Willie, we would have actually said something like, you know, get something for your Christmas presents, you know, get this sort of in from that point of view. I suppose just out of interest, do you prefer the physicality of the vinyl, you know, back in the day, or indeed even the cassette tape, dare I say it? Or is it a case of, no, give me the download every time?
I'm still drawn to CDs, I must admit. CDs are really my favourite format. Yeah. I do see the appeal of vinyl. I do love vinyl. My loft is full of cassettes because I was quite late in getting a CD player, and it was handy because I had my Walkman.
The great thing about cassettes is when you had a little pencil to kind of deal with it when they got turned around, and you could sort of fit the whole thing in that. Fantastic.
Exactly, yeah. And I've got money's worth of cassettes because I just had my Walkman stuck to me as a teenager and into my, you know, late teens too. But CD for me is the format. I think it's great. I think you get the physical product, and you get the great audio as well. I think it's underrated. I think people are a little bit snobby about it, but I still sell CDs to my small following.
And quite rightly so,
appreciate
too, in fact.
Them. Yeah.
I think actually my first ever CD purchase was indeed by a Scottish band. It was by Deacon Blue. And it was the Deacon Blue EP, the cover version of the Burt Bacharach number, I'll Never Fall in Love Again, and several others, basically, that Glasgow band, who also produced some awesome stuff in their time, is well worth sort of noting for. Have your circles ever crossed with Deacon Blue at all, and Ronnie McIntosh and so on?
No, but if I recall, I think when I was a little ratbag, Astrid might have knocked back a support tour with Deacon Blue,
right,
because
yeah.
We thought we were cooler than we were, because we weren't cool, but we had aspirations to be some kind of trendy indie band, and we were so wrong. And I would jump at the chance to play with Deacon Blue now. Ricky Ross actually played one of my country songs in his show a few years ago, so that was nice. Yeah, they're a talented band, man. Great songwriter. Yeah. Yeah.
Ricky Ross and Lorraine McIntosh, I think, that she was the backing vocalist for these work from that point of view. Excellent. Willie, it's been fantastic as ever. And I'm in a sense, whilst, you know, obviously we thought we'd have a few American sort of souls with us, etc., let them enjoy their Thanksgiving. I think we've had a nice little head-to-head on that sort of basis. But I've still got to ask you these two questions, which are standards from this point of view. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
Really enjoyed talking to you, man. Yeah, it's nice to speak to somebody that's informed about your music, because occasionally when you do interviews, it's quite obvious they haven't really listened to anything. So
yeah,
thank you for your time.
Well, as I say to my students, if you can't do your research, you shouldn't be in the business. End of. It's just lazy broadcasting. We can't work on that system. So the next critical question is, of course, can we look forward to welcoming you again? I don't know, possibly a kind of post-Hogman Eye sort of routine. Hogman Eye, I don't know. Will you come back in 2022 and speak more of your magical music?
Oh, absolutely. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'd love to.
And just a quick heads up in terms of how people can actually find you and locate you on the web. Do you have Facebook pages? How can people actually sort of get in touch with you?
Facebook page is Willie Campbell Music. And Twitter, I'm on there too, as Open Day Rotation, which is a bit of a mouthful, but I'm on there. If you search Willie Campbell Music, it'll all come up. And my website, williecampbell.co.uk.
Excellent. Well, the track is out there. It's Invisible Things. We've heard it once. Again, we're playing it again. But now, just for yourself, Willie, as you've never actually heard of him, I'm shocked. Harry Chapin and Short Stories.
Have you ever been up? Have you ever been down? Have you ever been lost? Have you ever been found? Have you ever been right? Have you ever been wrong? Have you come up short? Can you come along? Have you left your mark? Have you left alone? Have you seen the way? Can you come back home? Short stories, that's what we live. Short stories, they just take what they will do. Short stories, that's all it's ever been. Don't worry about the ending fate before we begin. I have seen the sun that's behind the rain. I have felt the joy that's behind the pain. Did you ever go soft? Did you ever run wild? I've been 100 years old. I've been a newborn child. And I have found a smile in the midst of tears. And I can find a heart. Short stories, they just take what they will give.
Don't you know I need you near me? All my happy ending's gone, and I see now so very clearly that our story must go on. Myself, can I ask for you to forgive your hope? Can we make it through? You know I need a dream, just like I need my breath. We got to take the life before we get to death.
Often said that if it was being sanctioned today, alcohol would never pass the first stage of the FDA or indeed any other drug advisory body. It is a drug. It is a problem. It is a challenge. Perhaps it's best never to start, but allowing for the fact that people do actually start and do actually engage in what's frequently referred to as the demon drink, it is clearly an evident the wide-ranging issue that occurs within the 21st century. We're in the middle of Alcohol Awareness Week, and to talk us through that, and also an interesting campaign called Help Me Stop, and some of the issues with respect to addiction in general, and certainly primarily relating to alcohol, we're delighted to actually welcome to the program today from indeed the Help Me Stop campaign, the Director of Missions, in fact, at Help Me Stop. It's Chris Love. How are you, Chris?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So clearly there have been lots of issues over the series of lockdowns we've been having about maybe people saying, oh, I'll just have another one. It won't do me any harm and so on. It is a big problem in terms of alcohol misuse that doesn't seem to be going away, Chris. I mean, is this something which sometimes we find it's a question of despair, or is it just a case of, well, we need to manage this condition as we would with most medical or psychological conditions?
I think you've hit the nail on the head from the outset there by describing it as a condition. It is our understanding and our experience that alcoholism is an illness and should be treated as with any other illness. There is a small percentage of the population that will experience this problem. And the starting signs of this problem are twofold, really. One is if when I take a drink, can I control the amount that I drink? Many people will set out with the intention of just having a glass of wine, as a large percentage of the population do at the end of a day, and find that over a period of time, they are consuming more and more. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're getting rolling drunk every evening, but they may well find themselves in a position where they're consuming an entire bottle when they set out with the intention of just having one. And that's certainly something that we've seen over the last 18 months as a direct consequence, as a direct result of the pandemic. Now, the second part of the challenge is once we've recognized that that is a problem and have a desire to stop, is can I stop for a sustained period of time? And again, many people can stop for a week, maybe even a month. But invariably, those people who are predisposed towards this condition will pick up a drink again. And that's the strange mental blank spot, the psychological aspect of this condition, is the belief that next time it will be different. It wasn't so bad. And the great obsession that one day they will regain their control over their relationship with the booze. So those are the two key signs, really, is can I control and can I stop? And we have seen so many people for whom it has become apparent over the last 18 months that they cannot do either of those things. And it's at that point that we can step in and offer them support.
The classic Alcohol Anonymous Steps to Recovery program will actually re-emphasize that point, that actually you never cease to be an alcoholic. You simply will actually just take one more day without alcohol, and you need to obviously maintain that whole system. Where does Help Me Stop actually differ from a program like Alcoholics Anonymous in terms of the services that you're providing?
So the misconception is that there is only one route to access support for addiction treatment or alcohol dependency treatment, and that is through residential addiction treatment, residential programs. We have set out with the intention of making an intensive intervention much more accessible for people. So we offer a non-residential addiction treatment program from our centres. And then over the last 18 months, we have developed and refined an online program. Now, all evidence points to the fact that the outcomes are much, much more successful by addressing this issue in the community. If you remove anybody from their environment and put them in a safe, secure space where they are supervised and given an opportunity to address the issues, then invariably they won't drink. However, once they return home and are faced with the triggers that existed beforehand, unfortunately, the sad truth is that many people relapse in a very short space of time. So by addressing the issue in the community, our experiences is that you get a much better outcome. And we set the path, we set people on the path for ongoing recovery. We are very much advocates of the 12-step approach, and we understand that people may well have a preconceived idea about what 12-step recovery looks like. And that's another myth that we are setting out to dispel by giving people an introduction to that process, but also by providing them with some early a period of intensive psychotherapy to really get down to the root causes and conditions as to why it is that people are doing this thing that they don't want to be doing.
Now, frequently we have not so much the people who are drinking who have the issue. They might say, we've got no issue whatsoever, but it's the people who surround them who obviously are deeply affected and can be in many ways traumatized by someone that they love going down this route of alcohol consumption. What advice do you actually have for somebody who's in that position? Maybe it's a member of the family, maybe it's a child, maybe it's a sibling, maybe it's a partner. How can they actually sort of cope with this whole thing in a way which obviously ensures that, you know, we don't end up in another tragedy?
And that's a very important point. Again, the whole theme of Alcohol Awareness Week is around relationships. And we understand that alcoholism as a condition is a family illness. But equally, our experiences is that our clients experience a family recovery. Now, the starting point for most people that we work with is actually contact from a family member, from a loved one, and they will be reaching out to us with concerns. Our suggestion, our recommendation is always to treat people with support and compassion in the same way as you would with any other illness, but to encourage them to take some positive action, chastising people, accusing people, asking them, you know, why can't you stop? If you loved me, you would stop. We hear these questions frequently. But letting people know that there is help for them, there's nothing to be ashamed of. We want to smash the stigma surrounding this problem and make recovery accessible for everybody. which is why we have created the programs in the way in which we've created the programs, to make them accessible and affordable.
And what led you, Chris, to this particular path of actually setting up this very laudable and praiseworthy program and option for people who are suffering?
Like 90% of the staff at Help Me Stop, I'm in recovery myself. My journey began in 2008. And for many years, I would have described myself as a functioning alcoholic. I had a promising career from a very young age. I built up what, from the outside in, looked a very successful life. However, my relationship with alcohol was getting progressively worse. And in 2008, I found myself in a position where I had the opportunity to take some action and embarked on this recovery journey myself. I was so impressed with the approach of Help Me Stop that when the opportunity arose to join the organization, it was too good to refuse. To present people with the opportunity to access the support that I got. And unfortunately, the landscape has changed. Back in 2008, there was still local authority of funding available for people to access addiction treatment. Without getting into a political debate, unfortunately, the world has changed. And the lion's share of the options that are available now are private. And when you consider a 28-day stay in a private addiction treatment facility can cost anything from £15,000 to £30,000, that's just off the table for most people. A six-week addiction treatment program with Help Me Stop online costs just £1,500. Which, whilst it isn't affordable to all, is certainly much more accessible for those people who fit into the mythical box of functioning alcoholics.
And indeed, as you said, an interesting sort of line in terms of some of the findings or some of the signs of a functioning alcoholic: drinking at inappropriate times, such as first thing in the morning, becoming irritable and restless if you're unable to drink for a day or two, an inability to say no to alcohol, regularly drinking to relieve stress, mood swings, becoming secretive or dishonest, all classic examples of dysfunctional behavior that actually can lead to, again, this misuse and this condition, as you mentioned. Helpmestop.org.uk, presumably the best place to go to find out further details about the organization and indeed Alcohol Awareness Week?
Absolutely, yes. We have a dedicated page on our website for Alcohol Awareness Week, which includes case studies of clients that we've worked with. You don't even need to pick up the phone. We have a live chat facility available on our website, so you can chat with us anonymously, safely, securely, but most important, confidentially. We will understand and empathize and lay out for you what your options are.
Chris Love, Director of Admissions at Help Me Stop. Many thanks and keep up the excellent work.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk with you.
Working from home, working from the office, getting back to the office, coping with life, working with the old stress factor of life. And yet, one of the things that isn't mentioned is what happens if you are poorly? What happens if you are unwell? Should you actually take a sick day? Do you feel guilty about taking a sick day? Well, according to the Fisherman's Friend annual cold and flu survey, Generation Z workers, or Generation Z, those born between the late 1990s and early 2010s, are most likely to call in sick, taking an average of 3.86 days in the last 12 months, compared with just 1.1 average six days for those over 60 years old. Okay, so far so good for the statistics, but what about the mental aspects of this? What about the way in which maybe we feel guilty about calling in sick? Maybe, you know, if we actually have to register online our sickness, our absence, we think, well, we might as well, if we're working online, continue working in any case. So let's not do it in any way, shape or form. Let's talk to our ace behavioural psychologist and indeed general all-round superperson, Donna Dawson, who I'm sure has one or two things to say about this. Donna, welcome to the programme. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me. Yes, this is research commissioned by Fisherman's Friend. It's part of their annual cold and flu survey. And they found out that two-thirds of Brits actually feel guilty for taking time off from work. Now, the days taken off for sickness have actually dropped by 60% from last year. And I think this corresponds with the number of people now working from home because of COVID. And it's interesting that When you work from home, you tend to feel more guilty about taking a day off than if you were in an office. And I think there are several reasons for that. One is that you think you should be able to roll straight from your bed onto a chair. And the fact that you haven't gone out and commuted to work has meant that you're not quite feeling all the aches and pains that maybe you actually do have. And funnily enough, when you're in an office and someone is cracking the whip over you, it tends to be human nature to want to kind of get out of it a little bit more than when you're your own boss. You tend to be harder on yourself, particularly if you're self-employed. And there's this fear of letting other people down, of making your boss upset. So what's happened is, Alex, we've now got a blurring between the boundaries for our workspace and our personal space, between our work commitment and our personal well-being. And this is because we're so get-outable. We're either on our laptops or our phones most of the time, and if not for work, then for social reasons. And I really think that we're now very confused about how ill do you need to be to take a day off if you're working from home anyway. And I actually created a little checklist that I thought would help people to decide that. And I think you need to ask yourself, if you're ill, how long can you concentrate for? So time it. If it's under 15 minutes, forget it, go back to bed. How long before you start falling asleep? If it's under half an hour when you're online, back to bed. If your body aches or on a scale of 1 to 10, about a 6 or more, go back to bed. If the paracetamol or Nurofen or whatever else you're taking has started to wear off before 2 hours, then go back to bed. The thing is, 82% of people in the Fisherman's Friend survey said they didn't know how ill they were till after they've taken a sick day. So you see how confused we are about how ill you need to be. The thing is, we don't tend to realize we're so anxious about not letting people down. If you're working below par at, say, half your normal level, and that would include a foggy brain, not being able to focus or concentrate, feeling too tired to think straight, or being distracted by aches and pains, you're not much use. If you think about struggling like that for a couple of days versus taking one day off just to sleep and get rid of the bug, you're much better off doing that, because in the end, you'll be a more efficient work machine if that's what you're worried about.
Yes, there's a whole new issue to be talked about in terms of, should you actually be seeking as your objective in life simply to be a more efficient working machine? But that's another debate for another discussion.
That's within work itself. I mean, the thing is, people are worried about what they're producing at home. And I think 12% of the survey very worryingly said that when they call in, people still contact them about things. So it's almost like they're not being recognized when they do say they're not well. And some people have even given up. They've said, another 21% said, I feel like I can't take a proper day off. So, you know, that's wrong. And I think the fact that we're working from home shouldn't cloud our ability to step back and just see whether we are well enough to do the work. I mean, you know, if you're feeling a little unwell and you still think you can cope, fair enough. And you may have a terrible deadline you've got to meet. But at the end of the day, it's only us that can decide that. And we have to try and do it separate from other people's expectations of us, which is very difficult, I know. And the younger generation that you mentioned earlier, Generation Z, they will be the most anxious about maybe their first job, their career prospects, making a good impression. So they may take the day off, but they'll suffer for it in anxiety. So, you know, it's a trade-off. Older people, not so worried. They understand their bodies better. They've been in the job longer. They know when they can take a day off or when they should take a day off. Whereas younger people who've just started working, maybe not.
Will this lead to burnout and a greater amount of burnout in terms of people because they get so caught up in that anxiety trap of, as you said, there is the sense, and it often produced by a lot of stories in the media, in which on one hand, we're supposed to be actually very much in the office, presenteeism still hasn't actually gone away. And on the other hand, we're still actually having to cope with, as you said, the efficiency and making sure that things get done.
Yeah, I think we are going to see more burnout. In fact, that was one of the questions that was asked in the survey. And again, that was about 82% of people feeling burnout. So it just shows that they are pushing themselves, perhaps to meet other people's expectations first. Although at the end of the day, you're not going to be much use to anyone if you're burnt out, and you're not going to like your job very much either. I think it's just, you know, something we need to think about. And being available on your phone or your laptop all the time presents its own problems. The thing is, if you are going to take a day off sick, put the phone away. Don't log on for social reasons, simply because you need a break from the whole thing, from the whole online experience, for your eyes, for your brain. And it's also not fair. I mean, because, and I think this is what people are worried about. If I wanted to check my Facebook page, then really I should be working as well. Just take a break from the whole thing. Believe you me, if you need to be contacted, they'll find a way. But I'm sorry. I'm really worried about people burning out now and not taking days off when they should. And yes, you can take the lozenges and wrap yourself in a duvet and be very comfortable at home in your pajamas if you're, you know, unwell moderately. But if you're really unwell, and I think we have to recognize that, you know, more of us are catching COVID too. And you know, that those symptoms are in the background. So really think about your health, because long-term, you're of no use to your own company if you're not healthy.
You mentioned, of course, Facebook, and now that Mark Zuckerberg set up Meta as the virtual meeting place and so on, perhaps there'll be even less chance for people to actually say, but I can at least send my virtual avatar in as a giraffe or a monkey
We'll all have avatars when we're ill. That will be it. And soon we'll be replaced by robots, but no, I hope not. And I actually think, I mean, going into the office is a wonderful thing, because you get to be with people and you get to bounce ideas off each other. But for this time in our history, we need to think about working virtually, but working virtually in good health, and not allowing virtual reality to kind of take control of us.
I was surprised to see that Stoke-on-Trent is apparently the UK's sick note capital, workers in the city having taken off an average of 4.7 days over the last year. Shocking. Followed closely by London, which I would have thought would have been number one, but London's 3.5 days and Birmingham 3.4 days. So least likely to have taken days off if you're from Cambridge or Norwich, apparently. I mean, I'm not sure whether you could...
Yeah, I wonder if being out in the country, people are healthier, you know, and breathing better air and not so stressed and not catching the bugs that we do in crowded cities. Mm. Because even if you're working from home, if you're going out shopping, you know, a lot of people are not wearing masks now. You're going to pick something up, which you could then bring home. Or if you've got kids that are going to school, again, that's another way to get a bug. But, you know, there are a lot more bugs than COVID. I mean, I've had a sinus infection the last 2 weeks, and I can't shake it. And when I cough, my daughter absolutely goes mad because she thinks it's COVID. I know it isn't. So we have to be aware that there's lots of other bugs out there that can get us as well.
Clearly, Donna, you need to avail yourself of some fisherman's friends.
Oh, for sure. I use them all the time. And, you know, they're great for your voice. So I just think, you know, work's important, but your health is probably more so. So it's really know yourself. Know what your limits are, and don't be afraid to say when you're really sick, and don't worry about other people too much, because you're not going to be much use to them until you're better again.
And of course, in those immortal words, nobody actually had on their deathbed, or indeed on their tombstone, I wish I'd spent more time in the office, virtual or real.
I love that expression. Sums it all up, doesn't it?
Exactly. Donna, where can people find out more details about the survey? Where would you point them to?
They can go to fishermansfriend.com.
Donna, it's been, as ever, fantastic. We'll wrap up with those two final questions. As an ace behavioural psychologist, I'm sure we could write a paper on the whole process. But have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been good for you?
I'm just getting to grips with technology. You know, I'm a techno dinosaur, but I'm just so happy whenever I do a Zoom meeting and it all goes well.
Well, there you go. So can we prevail upon you to join us again in the not-too-distant future when you come back and connect with us again?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Donna Dawson, behavioural psychologist extraordinaire. Huge thanks, and be well.
Oh, thanks, Alex. Bye now.